So it'll be put on the mobile transporter. And now it's on a track, and the whole robotic arm will move all the way to the endpoint where they need to install the science equipment. One's called Stage 3, the other one is called Raven Stage 3. They've been looking for that up there for a couple of years. Same with Raven. And I'll be attached to the space station permanently. But, yeah, they had a very successful launch. They managed to recover from this September 1st explosion, which blew up the Israeli satellite that they were going to launch from Launch Complex 40. That launch complex is still in disarray. They've done a survey on it. They know what they need to do to repair it. But after the explosion, they went wild. You know, everybody went from Launch Complex 40, building it, maintaining it, to finishing up Launch Complex 39A, which they took over about 4 years ago. They're leasing these two launch complexes from the government and NASA. So they completed 39A, and they successfully launched their first rocket from there. It's an important launch complex, Launch Complex 39A. This WS2N is the one that's got, a good history behind it. All the Apollo moon rockets, the Apollo was launched by Saturn V rockets. All the Saturn V rockets were launched from Launch Complex 39A. And eventually, many of the shuttles, over 50 shuttles, were launched from Complex 39A, and it was retired over about 5.5 years ago in 2011 when Atlantis made the final flight. So it hasn't been used since. And now it's now utilized by SpaceX. They rebuilt it on their dime. So, of course, government anything. And now he's ready to go. It's the same complex he's going to be launching the Falcon Heavy from probably 6 months from now, or maybe a little longer. Let me drop it. Just a few other topics we can go, do after this, but maybe you have some questions regarding this topic. It was pretty historic, actually, the rebuild of this launch complex and what was accomplished today. Back to you, Dick, for any questions, and we'll move on.
First, to ask to see if anyone has any questions for Paul on what he's given us so far. I should know and I don't know. Is there a launch pad 39 and another one 39A? I'm pretty sure it was 39A that I visited way back in 1971, I think it was.
Yeah, this is 39A. They gave it to SpaceX for the next 20 years. And then there's 39B. Identical to 39A, except there's a couple miles difference. So when the shuttles used to come out of the vehicle assembly building, they said, take a ride on the mobile transporter and all the way up to either Launch Complex 39A or 39B. 39A was the first one that they used in 1981 when Columbia first went up, and then a lot of flights after that. And then when 39B was completed, they started launching from there as well. And that's why I said there was only a little over 50 or 60 shuttle flights launched from 39A. The rest of them will launch from 39B. So, back to you, Dick.
That sounds like, in theory, it would be possible to make a simultaneous launch. One shuttle could be on 39A, one shuttle could be on 39B, and therefore, very close in time, two launches could be made. I think there was never any real need for that, except maybe a rescue mission. And my guess is the minimum amount of time between the 39A launch and the 39B launch was probably months. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
I'll have to check, but I think the most flights that they ever got off was 9 flights for the year. But after Columbia burnt up in 2003, Columbia was STS-107, that flight did not go to the space station. That was a science flight that was just going in orbit. It was around 23 degrees in inclination compared to the 51.6 that the space station is in. So there's no way in the world, even if they saw a problem on that, that they could get to you. The space station, you can't change that kind of an inclination with the kind of fuel you have on board a shuttle. So after that thing unfortunately burnt up, they were very worried about sending future flights up. So what they started to do is, since they had Launch Complex 39A and 39B, they knew that, you know, they would keep another shuttle ready in the hangar, and they could have bought one out if they needed to. But most of the time, in fact, all the time, they were going up to the space station to continue to build that space station. The only time that they actually had two shuttles on launch pads, A and B, was when they did that final Hubble service mission. In that case, they didn't have the time to do for instance, let's say they go into a space station. If they're going to the space station, they get up there and they check with their robotic arm and they find out, oh my goodness, we have damaged tiles all over and we're going to need to be rescued. There's two ways that they plan on bringing those people back, either staying up there for a long period of time and having more Soyuz spacecraft go up and start bringing back people that way, or actually sending another shuttle up. But needless to say, that never happened. But when they did that Hubble service mission, again, once you're up at Hubble, there's no way in the world you're going to get back to the International Space Station. There's a problem. So they needed to have both shuttles on the launch pad, and they did, and they were both actually ready to go. One went up, and the other one stayed there until the other one came back. That's the story on that launch. That Cape Canaveral is becoming a very busy place. Now, in June, they're going to have another launch. This is by Orbital ATK. They're revitalizing Launch Complex 46, and that's for another type of mission. So that will be coming up in June. We're actually pretty much rebuilt that complex. Now they're just testing things out. They're going to launch a Minotaur 4 rocket from there. Orbital ATK, which normally launches out of Virginia, needs to launch from the equatorial position for that particular satellite that they were contracted to put up. Now, Launch Complex, let's go back to Launch Complex 39A, the one they use today. You'll see another launch from that in 2 weeks. SpaceX expects to be able to turn around in 2 weeks to drop it. They have a big manifest of at least 70 flights in the next couple of years that they need to get off the ground. So they have their repair crews going to back now to Launch Complex 40, which blew up in September, and they plan on completely rebuilding that. And then they'll have two launch complexes operational in Florida. They'll have 39A to launch a lot of the NASA flights, and they'll have Launch Complex 40 to do all their commercial work. Most of their flights are commercial. You know, they send up satellites to geosynchronous orbit and that type of thing. So that'll launch, be from 40, and then 39A will be the NASA ones, and eventually people from 39A. They're going to build facilities for crew. They need to extend the height of the access You know, the shuttle was a lot lower. This is much higher on this rocket. To put people on there, they're going to need to have a gangway go out to the rocket itself. And the first crewed vehicle, although unmanned, they plan on launching by the end of this year, 2017. And probably by as early as the spring, I'm going to guess a little later the way things go, you'll actually have a first astronaut to take off from American soil, if everything goes right, next year. And then once it's certified, they'll be able to use it on a regular basis and send four astronauts up at a time to the International Space Station. And you can pretty much do away with the Russians sometime after that. In fact, Russians will probably be looking to go on our spacecraft. I wouldn't be surprised. And then eventually Boeing will come online with their Starliner, probably 6 months after that. So, any questions been out there before I go on? I'm going to lose other people. I might even lose myself. This is WS2N.
Yeah, I've got some questions, but before I do, let's find out, anybody standing by right now have a question for Paul on the space report and what you've heard so far? Give me your call limits right now, K2LIW and the TechNet. During the time when you had two space shuttles on two separate pads, one's going to be the rescue mission for the other. If a rescue was required, and you bring up a second space shuttle, because the first one is damaged in some way, what is the mechanism by which you transfer astronauts from space shuttle number one to space shuttle number two? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people think, well, it's going to be an EVA, but no, it's not. They had a system where the shuttle doors always opened up. But I was just back the second they got up into orbit, they opened the shuttle doors. If they couldn't open those doors, they'd come right back. That's how they got rid of the heat. They opened up the shuttle doors, and inside the shuttle doors, along the side of the shuttle doors, were radiators that would get rid of the heat inside the cabin of the space shuttle. Now, inside the cargo bay, you have a system where you have an airlock where you go into it, and then come through what's called a size of a pipe that you can fit through. You know, 1 meter is a little bit bigger than 1 meter, and you come through it, and then you be able to go up through the top. And where you're going to go from the top, well, you're now docked, let's say, to the International Space Station. That's how they dock through that piece coming through the cargo area. So now you dock to the space station. So you go out through the airlock in your space shuttle, go through this T mechanism. You go up the bullet of the T. The run of the T would actually get you into the cargo bay if you needed to do a spacewalk into the cargo bay, which they did many times. But if you go off the bulletin, you're going to go into the International Space Station. We drop the rescue vehicle. I think it was Endeavour at the time. They had an extension piece in the cargo bay. So you would have the two shuttles. One would go over one, the other one. And then, you know, they would be 180 degrees. You know, the tail would be facing the front would be facing the other tail, and then this the second shuttle would extend this instead of coming out of the bulletin T, you're coming out of a longer run on that, and now you attach the other space shuttle, and that's how they were going to do it. Actually docking with one another, and then go through this series of this maze of gigantic piping for you to bring your whole body through one to the other. So, you know, it's not like everybody needed an EVA spacesuit. You know, you just had your regular flight spacesuit on to go from one to the other. Back to you, Dick.
The piping you're describing, which allows you to transfer from one space shuttle to the other without going outdoors, without putting on a spacesuit, was that hardware built in the beginning of the design of the space shuttle, or is that something that was designed much later in the program? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, that was in the beginning. That's how you did your EVAs. You know, you would go through the back of the space shuttle. It's almost like, it's like an airlock. It is an airlock. And then, you know, everybody else is still in, you know, short sleeves in the deck. But your EVA crew is now in this little area. You get your spacesuit on, and you're able to continue forward. You keep going forward. There's a door that you would open up, and now you're in the cargo bay. If you don't go that far and you go the other direction, now you're going up towards the International Space Station. But of course, you got a spacesuit on. So everybody wouldn't have an EVA suit. They only have, you know, two or four EVA suits, whatever they have on, you know, depending on what the missions are for. That's it. Everybody doesn't have one. So you can't just, you know, do an EVA to go from one spacecraft to the other. If that system, for some reason, failed, they had some complicated system where, you know, you would go over with two EVA suits and one guy would go back with another one, and, you know, some complicated scheme that they could do something like that if they had to. Back to you.
The amount of time it takes to put on an EVA suit is so significant that to transfer people that way would be very slow. In the case of the Columbia, which was in a very different orbit than the International Space Station, and the chances of getting to the space station was zero. But had they known about the broken tile, and if in some reasonable length of time they could make another launch of a space shuttle, which I'm doubtful, what options did they have, Paul? Had they known about the failure of that leading edge tile, what rescue options did they have now that the mission is, you know, lots of years downrange and we can do a lot of thinking about? Did they have any options at all that we know about? WS2N, K2RIW.
They, well, knowing NASA, you know, and the astronauts, they probably would have, you know, and the contractors that work for NASA, they would have gotten another shuttle out there real quick. But it would have been an extremely dangerous situation. Not planned, you know, that type of thing. I just want to cover a couple other topics. I just wanted to cover it. I didn't do yet. Back to you, Dick.
Go right ahead with your other topics, Paul.
Okay, I just want to talk about Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser is another spacecraft that's being built for NASA by a company called Sierra Nevada Corporation. They've been in the space business for decades. And they are developing this, what looks like a mini space shuttle to carry up to seven people if they had to. But that's not the plan. Eventually, they wanted to have a crew being able to go up to the space station. And they put it, their bid in with NASA. And it didn't work out a couple of years back, maybe about 6 years ago. Boeing won a contract for a crew to go to the space station. And so did SpaceX. And they've been working on billion-dollar contracts ever since. But Sierra Nevada seemed to have got lost in the shovel. But then, 2 years ago, they needed to say, you know, we've got already SpaceX and Orbital ATK doing cargo runs with their spacecraft. You know, Orbital ATK uses Cygnus for cargo, and SpaceX uses the Dragon mounted on top of the Falcon 9 to do their cargo transfers to the International Space Station. These were $4 billion contracts. I think SpaceX had a contract for 12, and Orbital ATA had a contract for 8 mig. But time has gone by. Now they need, you know, another 6 missions, say, each, because they're going to need number 13, 14, 15. Orbital is going to need number 9, 10, 11, 12, and so on. So they needed to put another contract out. And this time they chose 3 companies. Again, they took Orbital with their Cygnus spacecraft, which is launched by Orbital ATK's Antares rocket from Wallace Island, Virginia, not too far from here. And they've been very successful in the last couple of launches. And again, they chose SpaceX with their Dragon using their Falcon 9. And they're launching from Cape Canaveral. Let me drop it. This time, the long-forgotten Dream Chaser will launch on a rocket, but will come back and land on a runway. Now got a contract, but not for people, but for cargo. So now you've got 3 American companies signed up: SpaceX, Orbital ATK, and now Sierra Nevada Corporation. And they've been working on this, and now they have one, a completed version, now out of California. And within about a month, it will be they'll be able to use that to I got a little beep on my radio. New radio here, by the way, Dick. So that's the story. They'll be able to use their spacecraft to. They got a contract for 6 flights to the space station. So that's getting. Got to drop down in power. How copy, Dick?
You sound good, Paul. Don't worry. That last beep seemed to be a lot less than a minute.
But the radio's got a heat sensor on it, so it lights up, beeps, and says the word heat on there. When you go on and on, it's high power. That's pretty good. Okay. So that's the story on Sierra Nevada. Now they're eventually going to have their spacecraft sent down to Florida in probably about 3 or 4 years. I think 2019 is the time that they'll start launching cargo to the space station. Now it turns out that this new administration is thinking about getting them to sign on with a crew, I guess sometime after that. So maybe someday they will have a crew on board this vehicle. They all already have a contract for Midland, Texas, to be able to land there. They can land in any kind of a runway. I think the runway, if it's 8,000 feet or less, they can land. So basically almost anywhere in the world. In Florida, on a shuttle runway, I think a couple of miles long. I think that's 15,000 feet long. So that would be no problem. Now, the good thing about the Dream Chaser is they use a different kind of fuel. They don't use the hydrazine fuel for the reaction control rockets. So when they land, which is extremely dangerous stuff, you don't want to inhale that or get that on you. When the shuttle used to come back, you used to see people out there. They look like hazmat suits and working on the shuttle right after they landed. You won't need that with Dream Chaser. They won't have that. They're using some kind of a propane gas type of thing. And liquid oxygen. I just think nitrogen tetroxide. I think they're going to use laughing gas. That's what it is. So that's the story on Dream Chaser. Back to you, Dick, WS.
Okay. Anybody with any further questions for Paul? Give me your call letters and name right now.
So I might want to know how this thing is going to get launched. That will be launched on an Atlas. An Atlas V rocket with a fairing over it. Actually, a 4-meter fairing.
And that was your last subject, Paul, or you have another one?
Interesting with that one thing I wanted to talk about was that one satellite that was going to go up by Orbital ATK. That thing is going to have a camera on it looking out. It's going to be on the zero inclination, so, but only around 350 miles up. It's going to be looking up at all the geosynchronous satellites, and it's going to be looking for space junk and problems. It's going to take inventory. It's going to be able to see a lot better than what NOAA can see with all their radar and everything. So it's going to be a Sentinel type of spacecraft. We're always talking about what are they doing, what's everybody going to do about all the space junk, and this is a step in that direction. If they see something, they'll be able to maybe move a geosynchronous satellite out of the way. So that's what that particular mission is for. Back to you.
What's the status of Iridium or future Iridium-like constellations of satellites? I think you were telling me there was a new constellation going up, and with all of those satellites, I presume they're medium Earth orbit satellites. How in the world, when they all have to go through essentially the North Pole, do they keep from hitting each other? Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
They'll be at slightly different altitudes. And yeah, the first group was launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base by, the Iridium Next, they call it. And they were launched successfully, about a month ago. And there were 10 satellites. Each one was about 2,000 pounds. And that's in the first group, first inclination, whatever it was. And then that'll change. That'll go up to a higher level. And then the next group will come in. SpaceX has a contract for most of those flights. I think there's two satellites that are going to go up by somebody else. But they're going to be launching 10 at a time. They got the contract for that. And they've got to wait until... It was going to be April, but I think it's July now. For the next launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Another 10. And then another 10 after that. This is going to happen, I think, 6 different times. And each time they're going to go into a different elevation. There's so much stuff up there now. I don't know how to keep track of it all. India, just two or three days ago, let me drop it, launched a rocket. They got some good-sized rockets there now. This is called the PSLV, Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. And they launched 104, it's a record, 104 satellites on one rocket. And then they have video. You can look for it on the internet. They have video of this stuff coming out of the back of this thing. And it looks like somebody took this, you can't see the satellite, but you could envision a garbage truck in orbit around Earth. And out of the back of the garbage, somebody's throwing satellites out of it. I mean, there's one right after. It goes on for like 10 minutes. You can watch all these satellites being literally thrown this rocket. It's incredible. I'm not a big fan of what they're doing with all these satellites and CubeSats. It's just too much to handle. Something's going to hit something someday. Back to you, Dick.
What made them think they needed that many? I think you said 100 satellites. What kind of experiment requires 100 satellites, Paul?
I have no idea. They're all different ones, Maybe there's a couple of ham ones in there. I don't know. I know a lot of countries are on board with this. And in fact, NASA has something on it. I don't get it. Aubrey more about this topic, but, you know, I knew it was going to go up. The record was 33 or 37 satellites. I forgot who brought that up. But, yeah, India, you know, with their 104 satellites. I don't know what they're thinking. And they look like, I don't know, maybe like three. Each one, it looks like about three CubeSats attached to one another. I'll have to read more about it, but just put it into the computer. India, PSLV, Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle, launches 104 satellites. You'll see a video. They'll show the thing launching off the satellites.
In the case of the Iridium-like satellites, 10 separate satellites, 2,000 pounds each. That's 20,000 pounds of total payload. And this is a medium Earth orbit, 10,000 mile high orbit, I think. That's a lot of mass at a lot of altitude. What in the world is the booster that does all that, Paul? K2LIW?
It's a little up 300 miles high, Dick. So that's what it is. I missed the question at the end.
I thought Iridium were a medium Earth orbit satellite, 10,000 miles. Go ahead.
No, I think it's 350 miles or something. I'll have to check. 50-mile area. It's not like the GPS satellites. They're 11,000. I don't know what else is in that category. Back to you.
The Indian launch of 100 satellites, are they at an altitude where they're not expected to last very long, and therefore they don't represent a whole lot of space junk because they're only going to be there?
Info. Yeah, maybe he's got info. I thought that was around 300 miles high, too. Back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Bill.
I wanted to mention that at a couple different maker fairs, there were mock-ups of CubeSats, and I believe the purpose, it's more of a form factor than anything else. I think it's something like a 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter cube, and there's a lot of different things that could be in there, a lot of Earth observation stuff, some ham radio stuff. Let me break for a second. I have not, I'm not sure I saw it at the last Maker Faire, but there were a few Maker Faires that had mock-ups of the CubeSats. And also they've got a great Wikipedia page, which could tell you a lot more than I could. That's it, AC2IS.
Bill, do you know the predicted lifetime of the CubeSats? And particularly the altitude at which the ones from India, the 100, were launched. Over to you, Bill.
That's variable. Some CubeSats have propulsion systems, some do not. I think the distinguishing feature of a CubeSat, again, is the form factor. So there's a launch system that's designed that can put them up, and then what's in the satellites themselves, each CubeSat can vary enormously from one to the next. So a CubeSat, I don't know what the minimum functional time for a CubeSat is, AC2IS.
Yeah, when I'm talking about lifetime, Bill, I'm not talking about electronic lifetime. I'm talking about satellite orbit lifetime. If the CubeSat is 10 centimeters on a side, which is about 4 inches, it's a 4-inch cube, I can't believe you can put very much fuel in there. So therefore, even though it may have some propulsion to do some maneuvering, I can't believe it can change the orbital parameters by very much. So how long you last in space is a function of how high is the orbit, how close are you to touching the top of the... closer you to touching the top of the atmosphere. That's one variable. Another variable is the mass-to-area relationship. A small object doesn't have very much mass-to-area relationship, therefore is going to experience a lot more drag and come back down and re-enter the atmosphere a lot sooner. Is it possible these CubeSats are only intended to be in orbit for, let's say, 1 year? Anybody who wants to answer that, go ahead, K2RIW.
I guess nobody's back coming back. I think I want to find out maybe if Bill saw that video and he did what he thought of it. Thank you.
You've got it, Bill.
I did not see that video. The only videos I'd seen of these CubeSats stations either. There were a lot of them done. And I think there's a... I believe there's a figure of number of CubeSats that have been launched by 2012. 75 CubeSats were in orbit by 2012. I still don't know what the lifespan is, but again, the propulsion system is something that would, you know, keep it in its proper orbit longer, and things without CubeSats without propulsion systems would deorbit, presumably much earlier. AC2IS.
Bill, to your knowledge, how many of them have propulsion systems? I somehow suspect that that's a rare item. And if you're using up your little bit of volume with propulsion, I don't think there's very much volume left over for very much electronics. Over to you, Bill.
Don't know the number. There are, they've got, again, it's basically just a form factor, so there's a variety of different propulsion systems. They've got compressed gas systems, they've got chemical propulsion systems, they've got electric propulsion systems. I'm not sure they've implemented a solar sail, but, you know, structure, a skeleton to them, it looks like this skeleton, again, I don't really have a lot of information on what's been deployed. I'll see if I can find something and call back in a little bit later.
You said electronic propulsion system. Does that mean they have a design, a working design, for an ionic engine that can squeeze inside of a CubeSat? Over to you, Bill.
I'm just reading now. Propulsion systems and antennas are the most common components that might require additional volume. I guess there's some CubeSats that are allowed to be more than the 10 by 10 by 10. So, I mean, there are propulsion systems in there. When I get the detail, I'll call back in on the electronic ones, AC2IS.
Thank you, Bill. 100 CubeSats. Wow. Is that just to get into Ripley? Do they really need 100 all in one launch? Paul? Wow. And what kind of parameters are being measured with these CubeSats? 100 CubeSats. Address 2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I don't know about that group, but... And there's probably been 100 total on... I wouldn't be surprised launch from the... space station. You know, they bring them up in different cargo vehicles, and what they'll do is they have to be finally assembled. And, Bill's right, all the CubeSats are 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters, you know, and then they'll put like two or three together, you know. It'd be cool. 6U, I don't know where they get that designation from, but you'll put like three together, and different size ones, but they're all nothing but cubes, 10 by 10 by 10. So, Dick, I know you like the Hubble story. There's a possibility, I mean, this is a long shot, but the President Administration and NASA had a meeting with the existing administration, and they Apparently, would like to see the Stream Chaser someday in the future, like 1919. I don't see that happening. Go up with a crew, and maybe some years after that, and go to the Hubble, and eventually service it. They're thinking about that. Thinking about it. And science people are trying to figure out if it's going to be worth it. You know, you've got these other telescopes going up, but they're actually mulling this around, thinking about using this reusable Dream Chaser spacecraft that's going to be launched on an Atlas V and eventually land on a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Another repair mission of Hubble might take place. And it doesn't surprise me because there's a lot of Hubble huggers out there. The latest issue of Scientific American on the last page has a great big graph of all of the zillions of missions that have been fulfilled by Hubble and all of the zillions and zillions of data that's open to the public, free of charge, so to speak. So there were people studying some of the data that was measured by Hubble 2, 5, 10, 20, 15 years ago and still using that data. So I can see how, I'll bet you there's going to be another repair mission of Hubble. I don't think anybody wants to give up on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
QIS info.
You got it, Bill.
Just reading up on the electric propulsion systems. Most of what they're talking about is plasma thrusters, electro spray thrusters, and resisto jets, whatever those are. The one thing they've mentioned as there may only have been one electric propulsion CubeSat to launch. It was called EST Cube 1 and used what they called an electric solar wind sail, which is not a solar sail, but something like an electrodynamic tether, which I think you guys know about. It deflected protons from solar wind in order to produce thrust. There was also, I think there was more than one CubeSat that launched with a solar sail. And I think that's it for electric propulsion so far, AC2IS.
Was that from the Planetary Society? WS2N.
The question was, were those CubeSats from the Planetary Society? I don't know. There's a great Wikipedia page. Cube 1. I thought it said it launched in... where's the launch date? I don't see that now. There's a NanoSail D2, which launched in 2010. A LightSail 1 launched in May of 2015. LightSail 2 is scheduled for March of 2017. If I drill into these links, I might be able to find out who put them together. And again, these are all very experimental systems. That's kind of what the CubeSat program is all about, AC2IS.
Okay, that's okay. I know there was a Planetary Society that had launched one of the light sails. I didn't know there were that many, but there was another one by Japan. Back to you, Dick.
So if I understand correctly, Bill, you're getting that data from Wikipedia. Quite possibly you did a Google search. And what was the search word you used with Google to get to that Wikipedia article on CubeSat?
What I typed in was CubeSat. I believe the Wikipedia entry was the second link. The first link was AC2IS.
You probably already told us. CubeSat was first invented how long ago? Roughly when was the first launch, Bill? Over to you.
This work on the CubeSat program, I believe, beginning in the 1980s. When was the first launch? I don't know. But there's some other system called OPAL, which deployed quote-unquote PICO satellites that I believe inspired the CubeSat program. Here we go. First CubeSat launched in June 2003 on a Russian Eurocot? Eurockot. Eurockot. And again, 75 CubeSats launched by 2012. AC2IS.
Sounds like a very successful program. 10 centimeter cube is very close to a 4 inch cube. That's not a whole lot of volume. 16 times 4 is what? Something like 80 or so cubic inches. I can't believe it put very much thrust in there, but I guess that's a larger size. Of these two articles I brought to about space that are in the latest issue of Electronic Component News that I brought to Paul's attention, one of them is an article which shows you what is the cosmic ray exposure like in space for an astronaut, we'll say. Page 23. Avoiding cosmic catastrophes, designing rad-hard devices. But it gives you a beautiful graph telling you how strong are the cosmic rays, how many of them are there. And one of the interesting portions of the article, all about 10 paragraphs downrange, is that NASA has estimated that a human crew will exceed their lifetime radiation exposure even during the relatively short 6-month trip to increase your lifetime risk of cancer by about 5%. So cosmic rays are a pretty serious problem, and there's no great solution for them. I mean, if you could put a zillion pounds of lead around each human being, you would give them quite a bit of shielding from the cosmic rays. But to launch that kind of mass in space represents a real problem. So for a bunch of reasons, I don't think we're going to see astronauts going to Mars in any reasonable length of time from now. The other article that I brought to Paul's attention that he didn't want to bring up, and I will, let me drop it, is that NASA has offered a $30,000 prize. That's their first offer. Guarantee they're going to have to raise that because I don't think they're going to get enough answers. They're looking for a solution to the longer space suit using. Right now, the spacesuits are designed where, under ideal conditions, it can be used up to 8 or 10 hours. But they see envision techniques in which you might want to keep an astronaut in a spacesuit for a much longer period of time. And if you can work out a technique by which an astronaut inside of a spacesuit will be able to remove safely his waste products from the spacesuit. I mean, a person in a spacesuit for more than 8 hours is going to have to dispose of both liquid and solid waste. And they're looking for a solution. How can you get the solid waste out of the spacesuit with a human being inside the spacesuit, I presume in a vacuum environment? Very difficult problem. And they've offered $30,000 to anybody who can offer a solution to that one. I don't think that's an easy prize to win. Maybe Paul's got an idea on that one. I'm having some fun with him. WS2N, K2LIW.
Very well done. No, I don't have a solution. They, running around on Mars, they plan on having, let's say, these cars. Put two or three or four people in it, and you'll ride around the surface of Mars, and the spacesuit will be attached to the outside of the vehicle, and you can enter it from inside the vehicle, you know, the back of it. You go through the back of the spacesuit, you know, you open the door, climb into the spacesuit, close the door on the spacesuit, close the door on the vehicle, and off you go. So they have that system. So this way you can come back to the large vehicle. It's like an RV, you know. And then you come back in, attach yourself, go in, eat dinner, go to the bathroom, whatever you want to do, and go back after work again. Back again.
When you're in this car on Mars, you got to be awful careful. All you got to do is get into an accident, fall into a rut, crash into a rock or whatever. There's a zillion ways in which your vehicle could have an impact with something, even very rough terrain, and therefore lose the air pressure inside. So, for an astronaut to put on a spacesuit, to go through all the procedure of wearing the inner and outer clothing and whatever, make sure all the joints are properly sealed and working correctly, make sure that very complicated backpack, which is providing just the right pressure of oxygen, nitrogen, water, drinkable water, water for cooling, and so on. Very complicated machine. There's a zillion things that can go wrong with it. The proper preparation and testing of that spacesuit when an astronaut puts it on because he's about to do an extravehicular activity. There's a lot more to it than meets the eye. We watch a guy doing a spacewalk, and the desirable portions of the spacewalk are part of that movie. And we make it look simple. I think it's not. And that extremely simple spacesuit that is being worn in the movie called The Martian. Why can't I think of that actor's name right now? Much too simple, that spacesuit he was wearing. And as I remember, he was making a multi-day traverse across the surface of Mars. And a lot of these details of him getting out of the spacesuit periodically in order to, let's say, go to the bathroom, all of those details, I think, were not covered in that movie. But maybe I slept through that section. WS2N, KQIW.
Yeah, they didn't spend much time on that topic. Even with the book, same thing. So, I don't know. Not much more to add, Dick. I'm watching the clock tick down. All I know is the supplies are on the way up to the space station. The last progress went out of control. You have another progress going up the 22nd. So the last one they lost from Kazakhstan, it wound up burning up in the atmosphere. That was a launch failure. So they needed this stuff, and it's on the way. Wednesday morning they'll have it. And don't forget we have two American hams on board, Sean Kimbrough and Peggy Whitson, both damaged. So we gotta supply them with more food, clothes, scientific equipment, all of that. Back to you, Dick. I'm going to be listening out. WS1.
The last progress that failed sounds like it got off the launch pad, but didn't quite get all the way into orbit. Is that roughly what happened, Paul?
Yeah, it didn't. They had problems with their third stage. They've had a number of problems with separating from the progress. It's not the first time. It might be the second. So they're working that. They apparently think they've gotten over that. And they're going to launch, I think, the 22nd, coming up a couple of days from now. That'll dock to the Russian side.
Okay, we've got 45 seconds or so left. That was space report number 239. That was TechNet number 1639. It's amazing how these numbers are piling up. We intend to be back next week. Bye bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And see you down the log. K2RIW clear.
C2IS, just wanted to comment that in the movie The Martian, they might not have covered all the details about going to the bathroom, but they did depict the astronaut as having severe negative consequences of having
been in that environment for so long, AC2IS.
What negative consequences are you referring to, Bill?
Aside from him being emaciated, he appeared to have, I don't know if you'd call them blisters, but sort of like, I'm not sure if they were open sores, but certainly sores covering large parts of his body, AC2IS.
That was in the movie or in the book? Bill?
That was in the movie when they do a spacesuit, you know, picture him getting out of a spacesuit shortly before him attempting to leave the surface. He was shown as being in very bad shape physically, AC2IS.
I missed that. Did you catch that detail, Paul, when you saw the movie?
I missed that, too. They just showed he was had a beard and he decided to get off, but I know he was in bad shape, though.
As I see it, for long periods of time, he had a very limited diet. I mean, what else was he consuming besides potatoes?
Ketchup.
That doesn't sound like a balanced diet.
In the book, I think he ran out of ketchup and they, sold 40 or something.
In the book, did they describe what was his diet other than potatoes, Paul?
That were on board on the station, which was intended to support some number of astronauts for some period of time. I don't remember the details. So he was eating everybody else's fuel, any kind of everybody else's food, any kind of backup rations they had, and then supplementing with his potatoes, which ended up being the majority of what he had. Yes, AC2IS.
Can I make a comment?
The machine's about to be cut off, but go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I'll try. And to Leo, something that really bothers me, which K2KNB, who was the president of Blymark, has been giving Hal K6DPD a really bad, hard time that Hal doesn't deserve. He is going to be receiving very shortly a subpoena to go to court.
For visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Bravo Mobile. Into Leo, into MV Mobile.